all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. Our guest today may be the farthest away that we've ever had on Veterans Radio. We're going to talk today with Greg Lovett, who's the producer-director of a film regarding burn pits. Greg, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. You are over in Europe, in Holland at the moment. So we're glad that we could make this connection and bring you to our Veterans Radio listening audience here in the United States.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, Greg, tell us a little bit about the documentary that you are in the process of finalizing called Delay, Deny, Hope You Die, How America Poisoned Its Soldiers.
So about a year and a half ago, or possibly 2 years ago now, I read a book by a man named Joseph Hickman called The Burn Pits. I read a lot of nonfiction, and it was one of those books that kind of, to be honest, just sort of pisses you off. It's sad, but it also makes you really mad when you find out what is happening to soldiers who served overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I had never heard about burn pits until I read this book, in which he described how the army was confronted with the problem of garbage, what to do with garbage, and how to get rid of garbage. And their solution on all these military bases, on about 200 bases throughout Iraq and Afghanistan, was to burn the garbage. So they threw all the junk that's accumulated in war into these big open-air pits. And when I say everything, I mean literally everything, from plastics, rubber, to dead animals, amputated body parts, medicine, even vehicles. And then they would set it on fire and burn it. And depending on the base that you were at, they may have been, quote unquote, little burn pits, but some of them, like in Balad in northern Iraq, was the size of several football fields and burned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So fast forward 10 years later, these soldiers are home and they're getting sick, and they're contracting illnesses that they really shouldn't be getting. A lot of these men and women who served overseas were, of course, healthy, and now they're contracting all kinds of illnesses, from respiratory problems to rare forms of cancers. And when you do the research and really look at the facts, you can link this back to their exposures from the burn pits.
And so, and Greg, as you read this book, and it's sort of, you know, as I say, it's interesting in a piss you off kind of way. How did that move you then to saying, I need to get this story out? I need to tell this in a different manner, and sort of lead you to the documentary film approach?
Well, I've been working in television my whole life. I've lived in Holland now for about 30 years, but before that in the U.S. when I was younger, my father worked in television, so I kind of grew up in the business. So I was producing, directing shows there. And for about the first 10 years in Holland, I also had my own production company and produced shows. But for about the last 10 or 15 years, I had kind of moved more into management. So I had been involved with different kinds of multimedia projects in internet and digital television and that kind of thing. And it was about the time I read the book that I was sort of thinking, I'd love to return back to my roots. I'd like to get back into production again. But I wasn't really interested in, you know, game shows or quiz shows or talent shows or the kind of thing that's popular on TV. I'm kind of at an age now where I think I'd like to do something that makes a difference. So I was sort of looking for a project to begin with, trying to think of an interesting idea. And when I read the book, to be honest, I thought, well, somebody's going to make a documentary about this. So, you know, that's going to be cool. Good for them. But then after about 6 months went by or so, last summer, really, I thought, you know, I talked to a couple people that I contacted from the book, and I started going on the internet, look a bit, little bit, and finding people, and nobody was telling me that they had been contacted by any other producer. So then I just thought, well, there's no time like the present. This could be my project. And from a personal point of view, it has all the things I was looking for. It has emotion, and it has drama, and it has, you know, controversy. And those are the kind of things that you also look for to create a documentary. It has to be interesting and moving. It has to keep people watching. And I thought it had an important message to tell, and I hoped that if I could get it finished, that it might help to create awareness and really maybe make a difference.
Well, I think that's one of the things that on Veterans Radio we try to tell these stories, because so many people are not aware of what's going on. And you know, they may not sit down and read a book that Joe Hickman wrote called The Burn Pits, but they will take an hour of time and watch your documentary. Tell us what's inside the documentary. Who are the people you interviewed? Is it just soldiers? Is there science involved? Tell us a little bit about the documentary.
Well, the story of how the documentary got made is actually interesting in itself, because obviously I'm over here in Holland, and the post-production could be done over here, but all the production work had to be done in the U.S. And I didn't have $100,000 to produce a documentary. So what I first did was I researched, who do I want to talk to? So I've talked to six soldiers, some who are terminally ill. I think about four soldiers actually appear in the documentary. I was scheduled to talk to more, but unfortunately, one died, one is now bedridden. So some of them were actually too sick to even appear. And so what I did when I found out who I wanted to talk to was I literally went on the internet and contacted some production companies locally. So for example, I interviewed a man by the name of Jesse Baca in New Mexico. So I found a production company in New Mexico that was willing to work with me, and they conducted the interview for me in New Mexico, and then one in Oklahoma and one in Oregon. And these people are all professional production people who are working, I don't want to say on a volunteered basis, but let's say for deferred payment. They provided their services at no cost, because once they heard about the story, they decided that they wanted to get involved. And that's the case for about the 15 or 20 people that I interview. I did interview several doctors, one in New York and one at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee. Both of these doctors have been conducting research for the past 10 years, and they're both convinced that the illnesses that they're coming across can only be caused by toxic exposure. I've talked to a lawyer, because a number of the soldiers are involved in a lawsuit against KBR. I mean, that's a whole other story in itself. KBR was a daughter company of Halliburton, and they had the waste management responsibilities on a number of these bases.
They were a private contractor that the United States government paid, I'm sure, boatloads of money to, yep, to manage this waste stream and waste disposal. Go ahead, continue.
And they didn't do it correctly. They were supposed to follow certain regulations, including EPA regulations in the states. They were supposed to treat these bases like little pieces of America, which by definition means you can't burn anything in open air. Obviously, they didn't do it, so they're being sued. So the lawyer appears in the documentary. I speak to a man by the name of Rick Lamberth, who actually worked for KBR. So he has firsthand knowledge of the mismanagement and of the cover-up that KBR committed. So it's a wide range of people that have different points of view that I hope come together to tell the story very clearly and concisely. And I think we get the message across pretty well that it's not only an issue of six soldiers, but it's also the politics of how KBR got the contract and how they mismanaged it. It also goes into a little bit about the treatment that they are getting, or I should say not getting, by the VA, because the government and the VA still deny that these soldiers are sick because of their exposure to burn pits. That means that they can't always get the treatment that they need, and so they become sicker, or in cases of some people, they have to pay for the treatment themselves. One soldier I talked to, appears in the documentary, has $250,000 worth of debt because of health costs that is not covered. So it's a big story with a lot of issues in it.
Well, and that's what I wanted to get across to our veteran radio listeners. We're talking to Greg Lovett, who's the producer, director of a upcoming documentary called Delay, Deny, Hope You Die, How America Poisoned Its Soldiers, focused on the use of burn pits in Afghanistan and Iraq. What's really different, I think, too, is that, you know, the waste streams that were being burned today as compared to 30 or 40 years ago, because this method is that, you know, it's been used time immemorial. It's a pretty crude way to get rid of stuff, is to burn it. But now it's full of batteries and appliances and plastics and computer chips and all kinds of toxic parts that get, pieces that get thrown into these burn pits. Is that what you found from your talking to the soldiers?
That's exactly right. They said that literally everything had to be disposed of in these burn pits because there was no other place to get rid of the garbage. Now, there's a debate about why didn't they bury it? Why didn't they ship it out? Why did they use incinerators? That's a whole other issue because, according to Senator Udall of New Mexico, incinerators were budgeted for, and KBR received money for incinerators, which would have burned everything at much higher temperature and would have deposited less toxins into the air. But they didn't use incinerators. So that's another issue. Nobody knows exactly why. And when you look at things like plastic water bottles, for example, I believe the average soldier in Iraq in the middle of summer uses 10 water bottles per day. Well, if you've got 20,000 people on a base, that's 200,000 water bottles, plastic water bottles that you're just burning every single day. So never mind just the plastic, but like you said, it's old computers, it's trucks. They would, the trucks that were abandoned or damaged or couldn't be repaired were just thrown in. And one of the doctors talks about how he found pieces of metal in the lungs of soldiers. Well, how else did it get there if it wasn't for the burn pits?
And one of the things that I think anybody who's been around a burn pit knows is you have a lot of what I'll call incomplete combustion. It doesn't really burn everything up like an incinerator is supposed to do. It catches it on fire to a certain point, and then the particulate matter floats away in the wind. It's incomplete combustion. Did any of your scientists talk about those kinds of problems of what we were putting into the atmosphere?
Yes. I mean, one of the soldiers, a doctor, kind of made a joke, but he said, you know, we're supposed to breathe clean air, and anything in the air can cause disease. So just anybody who's allergic to pollen or something, of course knows that. So anytime you're burning anything, it's going to damage you. And we have video of these huge plumes of black smoke that are just sitting over the base where the soldiers worked and ate and slept. And some of the soldiers describe it as thick as fog. And they all say that you actually had to wipe the dust off you. It would actually just fall on you. That's how much it was, how thick it was. One soldier even mentioned how one of their jobs was just cleaning the airplanes from the dust of the burn pits because it would prevent airplanes from flying. So it was actually something you could see, you could smell. It would burn their nose. It would burn their throat. It would settle on their clothes and obviously also in their lungs.
One of the things that is sometimes more convincing than words are the photos, the images. Were you able to find both videos and maybe satellite photographs or regular photographs of these burn pits to communicate the size and extent of them?
We were. It was tricky because at the time that the soldiers were serving, they didn't really think about it in the most cases. They didn't really think about that it was dangerous. Some of them just believed what they were told, which is it's not harmful. So they just thought, okay. So the majority of soldiers serving didn't think about making pictures or making videos. Having said that, I was able to find some soldiers who made, I guess they weren't iPhone videos back then because we didn't have iPhones, but very low resolution, bad quality video. But you can definitely see what it was like and what a burn pit really consisted of. There are some good images in the documentary, I think, of everything from smoldering pits, like you said before, where everything is not really burned. It's just sort of sitting there smoldering. And then we also have images of these huge plumes of smoke that just go, I mean, I don't know how many feet, but a lot of feet, 50 feet or so is what one soldier told me, into the air and floating over the barracks. So we were able to get some images to convey what it must have been like for the soldiers living there.
And Greg Lovett, producer and director of this documentary, were you able to find anybody either in the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, the Veterans Administration? Would any of those officials go on camera and take a position that you were able to incorporate into the documentary on burn pits?
They wouldn't talk to me. I did reach out to people at the Department of Defense and to KBR, for example, but they didn't want to speak. But I was able to find some archive material. For example, there's a man who used to work for the Department of Defense who talks about how they conducted, they being the military, conducted their own study into the burn pits and found out that there was nothing wrong. It was not harmful to live and work near the burn pits. Now, of course, I have other people in the documentary who refute that and talk about how that study was flawed. And I do have some archive material from KBR's lawyer who claims that they were just, you know, doing what they were told to do and it's not their problem. And of course, then I have the man who used to work for KBR who said, well, we weren't doing what we were told to do. We knew what we were doing was wrong, and we did it anyway.
Well, I think this is a informative topic and an aggravating documentary, and I mean that in high praise. I hope you take it that way, Greg. Tell us how the documentary is coming along and when it will be out and how people might view it and follow it.
Well, we actually just finished the documentary yesterday, which would have been the 22nd of May. We're just putting the last little frames or bars of music on, so it's basically done. Your second question is a little bit more difficult to answer because the life of a documentary filmmaker involves a lot of sales. So I have to go out now and sort of pitch it to, you know, the Netflixes and the HBOs and the Showtimes of the world and see if they're interested in broadcasting it. I've worked in the business for a while, so I have about a database of about 300 or so TV channels around the world that, of course, I will approach. I'm focused mostly on the U.S. because that's where this takes place and this is where the soldiers live who are most effective. So that's the market I want to focus on, obviously. I will submit it to some film festivals, and if you're lucky, you get picked up by some film festivals. A lot of these buyers of documentaries go to these film festivals, so they might see it, and then you know, they might want to then purchase it. So that's a whole struggle in itself. After you get the documentary made, that's really just part one. The second part is really going out and seeing if you can interest people. But I have about 1,200 people on our documentary Facebook page, so I can try to get them involved and they can write to Netflix and ask to see the documentary, and we can try a grassroots campaign. And basically you just have to go out there and hit the road, start knocking on doors and trying to drum up interest and find somebody who wants to buy it.
Well, let's direct some people to your Facebook page or other website or media accounts. Give us some ideas on how we can track you and track this documentary.
Well, you can go to facebook.com. And then /burnpitsdocumentary. It's all one word. So www.facebook.com/burnpitsdocumentary. And that will take you to our page. And there you can see some short clips of the interviews that I posted from time to time while we were busy. You can also see the trailer for the documentary, which you can then share. It's actually been seen by about 250,000 people so far, which is pretty good. And you can stay up to date with our progress and what we're doing. And you can see, how you might be able to get involved if you want to bring this to your local station or to Netflix or to HBO and help us get distribution.
Well, I want to encourage all Veteran Radio listeners to go to Facebook, I just did it myself, put in the Burn Pits documentary into the search bar. It'll come right up. It's you'll see Delay, Deny, Hope You Die pop up, and like it and follow it. This is the sort of documentary I think that not only veterans should see, but policymakers, family and friends, to understand what their loved ones went through when they were overseas in the sand pit. Is it your hope that this gets out into distribution in the next 6 months, next year? What's the normal distribution cycle, Greg, for a documentary?
Well, it can take a while. I mean, it can sometimes, you know, take upwards of a year, but I hope in this case that it doesn't take that long. I hope that people realize that this is a unique story, but it's also something that's happening now. It's current. I mean, you see soldiers in the documentary who are sick and dying now, and they need help. Their family needs help. And the more people that find out about it, the better. And I actually just did an interview with a reporter from Fox News in LA a couple weeks ago. She had seen the trailer and she was interested. And I mean, this is somebody who works in, you know, the television and media business, and she knew nothing about this. And I think the majority of people don't know anything about it. And actually, one of the doctors told me that he thinks the majority of soldiers don't even know about this. He thinks that there's a lot of soldiers out there who may be tired and winded and coughing or having rashes or other kinds of illnesses or irritations and not immediately link it to the burn pits. Right now, there are estimates of about 100,000 sick soldiers. He thinks that could be many more.
Well, and unfortunately, there are private doctors, and most veterans go to private doctors. Certainly, their private doctors wouldn't make that link, and even their VA doctors won't make that link. And I think that's why awareness is important, so you can, whether you're a spouse of a soldier or a soldier, say, hey, you know, since you can't really figure this out, could it be this? He lived here for 12 months and breathed this stuff in. Is that a possibility? And I suspect that that's what your documentary film here on Burn Pits would do, is sort of make people aware enough to ask a question.
I hope so, because a lot of the problems for some of the lung issues that the soldiers are suffering from is in the diagnosis. Dr. Miller at Vanderbilt University, who was really one of the first one to link some of these illnesses with the burn pits, discovered certain things only because he did lung biopsies. Now, I'm not a doctor, obviously, but a lung biopsy is apparently a pretty invasive operation. And so, for example, some of the soldiers were coming in and complaining that they just were out of breath. I used to be able to run, you know, my 2 miles in 10 minutes or whatever regulation time is. And I can't do that anymore. I mean, I feel okay, but I'm winded. And they would do normal examination, CT scans and pulmonary function testing and that kind of thing. And those all turned out to be perfectly normal. It was only when he actually went deep into the lungs that he would find tears in the lungs, that they would find metal deposited in the lungs. And the problem is the VA doesn't cover a lot of these invasive kind of surgeries, because they just look at the basic facts and say, well, look, you did these tests and there's nothing wrong with them. And he had to convince a lot of people, no, we need to actually physically go deeper into the body to figure out what's going wrong. He did that with a couple dozen soldiers, and he discovered that they're really suffering, a lot of these people, from a disease called constrictive bronchiolitis, which is a terminal lung disease in which the lining of your lung is actually destroyed. But then what happened was, when he reported his findings to the Department of Defense, who was actually referring some of these sick patients to him, the Department of Defense decided not to send any soldiers his way anymore and just sort of deny the research that he's been doing and the information that he'd collected.
Well, that's a sad state of affairs, but unfortunately not one that's terribly surprising to somebody who works in this area.
Yeah.
I want to thank you, Greg Levitt, for taking some time out today to talk to us about your very important and informative documentary. I want to encourage our Veteran Radio listeners to go to Facebook, go look for the Burn Pits documentary so that you can follow it.
It's just Burn Pits documentary with no the.
Ah, okay, excellent. Get the word out about this to people. I want to thank you for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. Well, we have a very interesting guest today who's actively involved with an organization that helps out veterans and creates recreational opportunities. We're talking about Operation Injured Soldiers, and our guest today is Pamela Bajanski. Pam, say hello to our Veteran Radio listeners.
Hello, and thank you for having me today.
I just realized I called you Pamela, and I don't think I have ever done that before. It made me stumble.
That's because we've always been informal. Yes. Pam is just fine.
Well, we're glad to have you on. Operation Injured Soldiers has been around since 2005. Talk to us a little bit about what its mission is.
Its mission is to get disabled veterans back into the field of doing hunting, fishing, whatever they have dreams of doing that they cannot do after doing active service with our country. Also, we're very strong in the camaraderie, getting veterans together with other veterans, because as we all know, just being able to talk to each other is just a powerful tool that we can provide. Not many places do that after the arena of war, and they kind of miss that, having each other's back. And there's very few places that they can go to now and have that kind of camaraderie. So that's what we strive to do.
And this is a nonprofit. Can you tell us when it became a 501c3 nonprofit?
Absolutely. We started in 2005, and 2007 we became a nonprofit based out of South Lyon, Michigan. That's our home base. So, yes, we're in our 12th year now.
And has the focus of Operation Injured Soldiers always been this sort of outdoor recreational activity?
It has. It's changed a little since then. We started out with basically hunting and fishing, but along the way we found out that a lot of other things also helped the veterans, especially the ones with the silent injury, the PTSD. We found that more high adrenaline things, such as shark fishing, skydiving, seemed to have a lot of soothing effect with PTSD. So we kind of started branching a little away from just the hunting and the fishing, doing a little more just recreational things.
Well, let's back up a little bit. How many events does Operation Injured Soldier have in a year?
Approximately nationwide, varies between 54 and 80 in any given year.
Holy cow, that's a lot of action going on. Something every weekend or week is going on, it sounds like.
Pretty much so, yeah. Sometimes even around the country, a couple in a weekend.
And how many veterans find their way into your programs over the course of a year?
Right now, we're standing at a membership at about 2,700 veterans. But as word is getting out, we're growing daily. In the last year, we've had a lot of great exposure from a lot of great organizations. And any given day now, we could be growing 2 to 3 members per day in our membership.
So you mentioned that fishing and hunting is kind of where it started, but then you said something like shark diving? What else?
Shark
fishing. Okay. Shark diving would have my adrenaline going too. So
No. Shark fishing and skydiving.
Ah. So what other types of outdoor programs do you find that Operation Injured Soldier can bring to bear for disabled veterans?
We have kind of partnered up with Mark Martin, who's a professional walleye fisherman. He does seminars twice a year for our veterans to teach them how to do walleye fishing. We have a muskie meet every year on Lake St. Clair where the veterans are taken out for a catch and release with muskie. We do the shark fishing down in the Gulf of Mexico, and deep sea fishing down there as well. We do skydiving, various places around the country. We also have a really great program called Heroes on the Dunes that's done at Silver Lake State Park in Michigan. And it's usually the first weekend in August where the dune buggy enthusiasts up there take our veterans out on the dunes in dune buggies. That's a really, really popular event for us. We also do a lot of spectator sports. We do U of M football, MSU football, tailgate parties, Detroit Tigers, Lions, Pistons. We do a lot of spectator sports as well.
And do you, I know car racing around the country in different locations is a big deal. Have you been involved, has Operation Injured Soldier been involved with that as well?
Absolutely. NASCAR. We have.
And how do you run these programs around the country in this kind of fashion? Do you have a big organizational staff, and how does it work?
We are, one thing about Operation Injured Soldiers, we're an all-volunteer board, and everybody's volunteer. We don't get paid. We have different people throughout the United States that have taken the vow that we have to give back to the veterans as a thank you for what they did for us. And they coordinate these events for us around the United States. They're the ones that solicit for the tickets. They're the ones that get the veterans together and help host the party.
And is there a criteria for the type of service or the type of veteran that can be, if member's the right word, a member of Operation Injured Soldier?
Yes. Our 501c is based on disability and education. So to become a member of OIS, you need to have a 30% or more disability, or you need to have seen combat. But any veteran is welcome to join our organization because there are some things in the education field that they're eligible for as well, such as educational weekends like Mark Martin's where they're teaching fly fishing. We have hide tanning so that the veterans can learn how to get extra income. So for the basic programs, yes, 30% or more combat, but basically any veteran can sign up for some other things that we do as well.
And if there's something going on almost every weekend somewhere in the country, how do people keep track of what the available options are?
What we do is we have a strong database that when something is going on in a certain area and you're a veteran signed up in that area, you get an invite through an email. So that if you're within a 200-mile radius and that event is something that you think you might like to do, that's how you're notified of that event.
Well, I know somewhere. Hang on. Let me shuffle a little paper here. You've got upcoming events or have had already events in 2017 in New York. There are other states where it seems like you have a pretty strong presence. Maybe you can talk about some of those locations.
New York, we do have a strong database. Michigan, we're strong in. Florida, we're strong in. Kansas, we're strong in. In New York, Ed Spence, we have a representative that we brought into a hunt one year, and he just became on fire, and he said, I want to do this in New York State. So he went back home. He solicited to the people for the hunting and the fishing trips, and he's built the area up. Florida is the same way. We have another veteran down there who said, I want to do the same thing back. So he would solicit the charter captains for the shark fishing and the deep sea fishing. He does the same thing. He runs the whole event. He brings the veterans in. He coordinates the whole event and puts them back on the plane and sends them home. Kansas, we have a hunting lodge called Gumdrop, and it's in Blue Mound, Kansas. And in Kansas, we do a lot of basically just hunting because the game is so large out there. The deer are larger. We do waterfowl and we do turkey out in Kansas. South Dakota, we do a little bit of waterfowl out there. And then, of course, Michigan, we have a wide variety of things.
So if I'm a veteran in Illinois and I want to go out and do some hunting in Kansas, can I participate in an OIS program out at your Blue Mound Hunting Camp?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And what would be the charge for an Illinois veteran to go do that?
Absolutely nothing. We do everything free of charge for the veterans. Every event that we have, there's never a charge that's given to the veteran. Sometimes, especially if they need gas reimbursement, we also even do that if it's necessary.
Well, tell us a little bit about what you have out in Kansas, the hunting camp and the property, and then we'll also talk a little bit about another property that you have here in the state of Michigan.
In Blue Mound, we have a lodge called Gumdrop. That was donated to us 2 years ago. It was just a small lodge that they donated for us to take our veterans down. It sleeps about six to eight veterans down there. It's like a full house, like a lodge. And then the property owners in the area have offered to our veterans to come out on their land and hunt.
So the hunting property is being provided by supporters of
mm-hmm.
OIS.
Absolutely.
And in those situations, whether it's hunting or fishing, the veteran is outfitted with whatever is necessary in terms of hunting or fishing licenses?
Yes, and most of the time we do reimburse for that. We help provide them with that as well. Because in Kansas, when you're hunting out of state, it can get pretty bitey to get the licenses. So we go out, and that's part of what we raise our funds for, is to help the veterans. So it should never be a burden for the veteran to financially to attend any of our events.
And similarly, whether I'm out, I don't think many people would have their own shark fishing rigs. When I'm out doing one of your events and I need sort of special equipment to participate in the event, how is that handled?
That's all provided. That's all provided. That's part of what the charter captains have on board.
So I think I saw somewhere that about 600 disabled veterans participated last year. You made a whole lot of people happy.
We sure did. We changed a lot of lives.
What sort of impacts do you see from folks who kind of maybe get out and do this?
You know, when first-timers come in to the organization, obviously they don't know what to expect. So we try and get someone who's been on a few events to try and mentor that person through so that they feel a little more comfortable. Nobody going into something unknown the first time, uncharted waters, is hard for anybody. So we kind of bring them in. We tell them about the organization. We kind of show them around, introduce them to new people to try and make them feel a little more comfortable. So by the time someone walks in the door and they have this nervous look on their face, by the time they leave, they're taking numbers of other veterans to just have camaraderie with.
And are there situations where folks might be in wheelchairs or in some other situations that limited mobility, are you able to accommodate those folks as well?
Absolutely. OIS has three action track chairs. We have rangers to get the veterans out into the woods. We also have a sip and puff gun where a quadriplegic or any veteran that's wheelchair bound can wheel up to this gun, and it is basically done with sip and puff. He blows into the mouthpiece to shoot the gun.
Well,
so we have a lot of equipment for that.
We're talking to Pam Bajanski, who's the treasurer of Operation Injured Soldiers, and we're hearing about the fantastic recreational opportunities that this nonprofit creates for veterans all around the country, in New York, Florida, Kansas, South Dakota. One of the unique features that OIS has is an estate called Brave Hearts Estate. Can you tell us about it?
In 2015, actually on Veterans Day in 2015, a veteran donated that property to Operation Injured Soldiers. It's an 8,400 square foot home on 238 acres. It has 8 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms, and his wish was for us to carry on what he wanted that to be a bed and breakfast for veterans. He wanted it to be a place for veterans and their families to go at no charge, just to be with other veterans, and it just to say thank you. Thank you for your service. There's no charge for anything. Just come up and enjoy the beauty of the land, the estate, and the surrounding areas.
Well, tell us where Braveheart Estate is located.
It's located in Pelston, Michigan, actually to the right to the side of the Pelston Airport. It's about 15 miles north of Harbor Springs in Petoskey, and it's about 15 miles south of the Mackinac Bridge in Mackinac Island. So it really, scenery, there's always something to do up there.
Well, Veterans Radio listeners, wherever you are in the country, you're going to be hard-pressed to find a nicer slice of the country than Northwest Michigan, where Braveheart Estate is located. It's a gorgeous area. And as you say, you've got close by all sorts of nice cities, cute cities, Petoskey, Harbor Springs, Charlevoix, Mackinac Island, Mackinac City. It's a great location. Tell us how it's being used by OIS.
Right now, for the three-quarters of the year, we use it as a bed and breakfast for the veterans. So in other words, anybody that's listening or any member of our program, they have to get themselves up to there. There's no gas refunded on that. But once they get there, we provide them with a breakfast and we provide them with a dinner. We provide them with their own bedroom and we provide them with things to do in the area. Or if they choose not to go out sightseeing, they're welcome to stay at the estate. We have many trails to ride around there. We have pool tables. We have lots of things just to do at the estate, just in case you don't want to go, you don't want to leave. But we also have vendors on Mackinac Island that have donated tickets for our veterans to get over to the island. The Icebreaker Mackinac gives our veterans free tours to go through there. The Lumberjack Show gives our veterans free shows whenever there's any up there. So the whole area in northern Michigan has embraced the veterans. We're very proud of that.
And again, this is one of these opportunities OIS has created. And if you have limited mobility, if you're in a wheelchair, this is an accessible opportunity, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We have an ADA-compliant bathroom. We also have chairlifts on all of the stairs. So it's very accessible for handicapped.
And now you've mentioned there's even here as operating as a bed and breakfast, there must be somebody taking care of things. Can you tell us about that?
We do. We have a couple that are caretakers. They're Paula and Mike Brown, and they take care of the whole estate. They could do cooking. They do the cleaning. They give you hugs. They give you they send you in the direction of where you want to go. They're just wonderful caretakers.
And I noticed from the information on Braveheart Estates that there's a wide variety of activities kind of all through the year. But one that caught my eye that's a little different would be the Lady Veteran Retreat Weekend. Tell us a little bit.
Yeah, I said three-quarters of the year we do that. The other quarter of the year we do retreat weekends. And one of our female veteran, we have a division called Operation Yogi, and they raise money for our female veterans. And our female veterans go up usually twice a year just to be together, to play games, to do crafts, to go to Mackinac Island, to go bowling together, to just be together. But on top of the female veterans, we also have PTSD retreat weekends. We also have caregiver retreat weekends. We have equine therapy. We have hide tanning. We have ice fishing classes. We have casino weekends. We have wine tasting weekends. We do have some theme weekends where we do have, that's what we do the rest of the year.
Well, I think the retreat weekends are a great idea, and it's a great way to help certain groups, whether it be caregivers or female veterans, or I see the Saginaw VA men's retreat on here. There's a Leatherneck Motorcycle Club retreat. There's probably a whole bunch of different groups that find this to be a unique opportunity to build that camaraderie you're talking about.
Yes, the VA, the Saginaw VA, the Sheboygan VA, quite a few of the VAs are coming on board wanting to do their retreat weekends there because it's perfect. It's just the perfect place for it.
Well, all of this comes at no cost to the veteran, but it doesn't come at no cost. So could you
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit, particularly Pam, since you're the treasurer, could you tell us a little bit about how does Operation Injured Soldiers raise the funds to keep all these wonderful activities going?
We raise our funds basically by donation, by corporate donation, individual donations, grants. And we're very proud to say that 93% of the money that we raise goes back to our veterans and the programs that we're working on. We have two major fundraisers in Michigan. One is our golf outing, which is May 19th at the Links of Novi, and our annual Lion Ride, which is on July 8th in New Hudson. Those are big fundraisers that we have. Bravehearts Estate is also now doing its fundraisers, too, where the Leathernecks are doing a motorcycle fundraiser on May 27th up at Bravehearts. We're also doing a 5K color run June 24th up at Bravehearts. So we volunteers work to try and raise these monies because, as you say, it just doesn't fall into your laps. We do this as our way of saying thank you for your service.
And as we reach out to our veteran radio listeners around the country, if there's a way that they want to donate to Operation Injured Soldiers, how would they do that, Pam?
Several ways. They can call us up and say, hey, I want to do what you're doing out here in South Dakota, North Dakota. I want to get a hub going out here. Teach me how to do this. How do I raise the money? How do I bring the veterans in? Help start another hub in your area of the country. We can mentor you very well in how to do that, how to raise the money, and then how to coordinate an event.
You said they should call you. Let's give them a phone number.
You could anytime between 9 and 5. We have a manned office in South Lyon. Her name, Michelle, is our office administrator, and you can reach her at 248-437-3130. And if you can't remember the number or I said it too fast, you can always email us at info@injuredsoldiers.org.
And can you give us the website for the organization?
www.injuredsoldiers.org.
Nowadays, everybody's on social media, it seems. Pam, does Operation Injured Soldiers participate in any of the social media platforms that listeners should look at?
We do. We have several Facebook pages, one being Operation Injured Soldiers, the second one being Bravehearts Estate. We also, which I failed to mention, have a 3D archery course at Bravehearts Estate that anybody in the public can come and use for a donation, and any of our veterans can use, and it's extensive, beautiful 3D archery course up there. So we also have a Facebook page for that as well.
And as we start, beginning into the summer of 2017, how does the year look for OIS programs throughout the country?
Right now, we're ahead of the pace of what we have been in years past. Actually, more people are opening their arms and joining our cause. So I predict that we're going to have one of our better years this year.
Well, that's great to hear. And we're glad, Pam Bajenski, that you could spend a little time with us on Veterans Radio, telling the story of Operation Injured Soldier. I'd encourage our listeners to look him up on the website or in Facebook and see if there isn't a way that you can help out or participate. Maybe you're a veteran who should get into one of these programs, or you know somebody who could really benefit by participating in this kind of recreational activity.
Also, veterans can also sign up at theinjuredsoldiers.org. There's a place where veterans can also sign up.
And that will let you then send them emails when things are happening in their area.
Correct.
Great. Great information to know. So I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans. You can reach us at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to our podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.